Very nice. Thanks a lot, everybody, for taking time to attend this talk. Really do appreciate it. Before I go very far on this, I want to be sure to remember a couple things. I want to acknowledge some of the people who made this happen. There are three workers, three very strong individuals, two who collected samples, Ian Guest and Jack Nebola, are the two fellows who helped out. They're ARS employees in Pullman. And I must say that the task associated, the physical effort associated with this project was quite daunting. And I have to really say that that was fantastic. So on that note, my name is Wayne Thompson. I've worked on this project with Dave Huggins this year. And so he and I put together a presentation where I hope I can describe what we were trying to do. In 2014, we initiated the project to evaluate what the practicality of planting a cover crop in a semi-arid environment might be. So there were questions out. Farmers abounded with curiosity. Some were highly resistant. Others were thinking it was the best thing ever. So everyone asked the question, just exactly how much water can we sacrifice or use or devote to a cover crop in order to develop better soils or to maintain higher soil quality. So the big question, of course, was how much water. So we selected five locations across a rainfall gradient. Let's see, I'll try to use this mouse. Let's see, yeah, there we go. So we started out planting in the earlier in the season on the east side. This is in southeast Washington, up on top, high elevation area. Again, over here, this is high elevation. Somewhat drier. This is slightly wetter. This is drier. Up here, this is a very high elevation point on the north fringe of the Blue Mountains. It's a very high rainfall zone. Annual cropping is common, but on occasion you'll find some fallow cropping, especially now with the El Nino effect. We're seeing a little more fallow work because, of course, the drought condition. Now down here in Site 5, that's another high rainfall area. Where it looks like there is plenty of water. As a matter of fact, when we pulled cores out in the spring after the winter rains, we've had water running out the tips of the probes, which is pretty amazing. That was a very wet site in 2014. Not so wet in 2015, but it was still a good site. The Site 3 plots were on a very, well, let's say, referred to as a Ritzville soil. It's a very sandy soil in a very, very, well, almost arid environment. It's a very dry area. The average rainfall is typically in the neighborhood of 30 centimeters a year or less. Recently, it's been less. So as that indicates, most of that moisture accumulates in the winter. And then, of course, they have to fallow in that area because of the low rainfall conditions. And so in 2015, we selected these three locations, sites 2, 4, and 5, because they seem to be some of the higher rainfall areas that might show more potential in sustaining a cover crop under good management. Site 3 was wiped off the map because it's clearly not something that one could use for producing a cover crop, unless, of course, you're using irrigation. I better speed up. driving question, of course, what is the water balance trade-off of building soil quality with a cover cropping system versus allowing for increased water storage with a conventional dryland fallow system? Everybody knows fallow, correct? Raise your hand if you don't. Okay, good. So I'll assume you all know. So what we'll do now is very quickly review the weather conditions that are typical of the Pacific Northwest. On the inland Pacific Northwest, the dry side, the rain shadow side of the Cascades. And then quickly I'll run through soil profile, water use detail, information, and in fact, why we did this and the results of this study. Goal 1, determine the amount of water consumed per unit of cover crop above ground biomass produced. You see we have daikon radish there, and I measured the roots as well, but I wanted to make sure that we had a method of calculating water removal using a fairly simple above-ground approach. So I focused on the above-ground biomass. That was the logic. And then, of course, that's all relative to fallow systems. Under dryland conditions, with wheat straw cover. Not bare soils, but wheat straw cover. Big difference there, soil temperature-wise and infiltration and so on and so forth. Instrumentation, pretty standard. Weather stations were used. And here's a quick example of what we ran into. There's some detail in these images. On the left-hand axis, y-axis, is air temperature and precipitation events in hours. The blue dots, the vertical dots, indicate precipitation events and their duration. On the left-hand axis, is hours of precipitation events. So we can see that there are only a couple precipitation events during each location that lasted more than 10 hours. For example, at site one, we had 4 events. 5 that went over 5 hours. And site 3 is a very dry site on the west side. I just wanted to show this because it is very dry. Take note on this where you can see the dry events where the hours of dry cycle without any precipitation, dew or otherwise, are very long, up to nearly 400 hours early in the growing season. And so as we can see, there's a huge amount of water stress associated with growing anything in those locations. And by the way, air temperatures are quite high there as well. That data is not all presented. It is presented, in the diurnal charts in the background. You can see the up and down zigzags of the diurnal temperatures. Site 5, that's much more higher rainfall zone. This depicts roughly when we initiated the plot setup. And you can see with all the blue dots congregating on the left-hand margin on that lower plot that we had quite a number of sequential rainfall events with minor dry cycles intermixed with those. And then we migrated into these longer dry cycles with more precipitation events. Enough of that. Now, very quickly, let's think about degree day accumulation systems and as to how we might be able to select species appropriate for that location. Cool season is a high demand because, of course, anything that when you move into the C4s up in the Pacific Northwest, especially in the dryland conditions, typically you need to plant in a cooler period of the season when accumulation rates are slow, and as a result, by the time your biomass begins to accumulate above ground, the seed has spent maybe a month in the soil. That's a problem. And then, of course, by that time as well, much of the soil is drying down, so it's a problem. I think that point is clear. Any questions on that, we can talk. What we used to generate or develop the concept for this project was a simple E plus T equals ET, evaporative water loss plus transpiration equals evapotranspiration. So we moved on that. So in our situation, the assumption is that we would calculate an ET for the crop where we measure pre-season, pre-session or pre-window soil moisture, moisture content, soil profile moisture down to 5 feet or so, and then again after that window of time. And I'll show you later what we mean by windows of time and so on, but incrementally through the season, we captured soil profile moisture status and then used that information to calculate or estimate or approximate an evapotranspiration rate. Next is evaporative water loss, and we used the fallow plots, adjacent plots without crops, to then approximate what is being lost as evaporative water. And of course, the interest is to replace fallow with cover, so I wanted to use a direct relationship with the system that we would be replacing, therefore the fallow numbers. Finally, with T, which is the most important component, and because that is the amount of water used by the cover crop above and beyond, which would be used by the fallow system. So with this, we simply assumed that we would calculate ET and subtract from that number the E to receive transpiration rates. So how did we do this? At site 2, we were able to collect 5 samples. This is a winter wheat crop, so the plants were in the seedling stage very early on, and so we collected the biomass, and you can see how much there was. It was a very, very small amount of biomass. And then we migrate through that growing season that then create a growth curve, so we basically have a growth system, and you can see on the legend that that's a dry matter, and that's a nice relationship, very powerful, strong relationship, statistically valid. So then from that we calculated the evapotranspiration rate, as I described in the previous formulas. And then from that, too, we also calculated E from the fallow. And so we have the ET, E, biomass accumulation. And from all of that, we can then calculate T, the transpiration rate. That is the, okay, transpiration rate in brackets. We can calculate the amount of water consumed to generate the biomass that exceeded the amount of water that was lost as evaporation in the fallow conditions. Let's look at that again. This is the winter wheat. We had two sites with daikon radish mix, and they're very similar. So I'll just show you one of the two. And so there we generate our curve again. And by the way, at each of those points, we collected gravimetric soil moisture at both the fallow and the crop condition. We also collected biomass samples. And so that was really it for the data, but it was a huge amount of effort. And here we can see that we had another ET calculation based upon the soil gravimetric moisture status variations over time. The evaporative water loss, again, creeps in at the bottom of the plot. And then finally, we can then generate the T with this. And then if you calculate the area under the curve or you go through the process, we can then say how much transpired water does it take to create X amount or Y amount of biomass. So very simple, nice, strong relationships that we found. We have winter wheat. R square is 0.7 with only five samples. And then with a few more samples, we were able to generate a very strong relationship for the daikon. Now notice the dotted lines that sort of bracket the bolder green vector line we have here. That's the difference between the two sites, sites 4 and 5. Statistically, no difference in slope, so I present the individual slope. So ultimately, that's the important thing. How are we doing on time? Very well. Oh, 4 minutes? But it's okay, so I have actually, if I did, okay, thanks. Yep. Anyway, sorry. Anyway, yeah, so here are considerations. Now, how many folks have considerations? Did that make sense? I mean, it was pretty clear. Now, okay, let's back up and think about that. Okay, so we can calculate roughly how much biomass we can use or generate to then exhaust X or Y or X amount of water. So if we're looking across that rainfall gradient and we do pre-season moisture status evaluations of the soils, we in theory then could determine whether or not we have enough water to generate the biomass needed to create a good grain crop. Because typically, now keep in mind, here's one thing I neglected to emphasize, and that is we were looking at 30-some centimeters of water, up to, you know, quite a bit of water used to generate this biomass. Well, ultimately, during the rainfall, during the growing season, we're getting somewhere in the neighborhood of 1 or 2 centimeters, you know, not many, 10 centimeters, not very much rainfall. And by far the majority of that rainfall is actually from the stored water status of the soil. And so we ultimately need to rely upon that soil water that's stored through the winters to then generate biomass during the growing season. Of course, our harvest index will vary. And you notice I didn't go into detail, but, you know, there's a lot of information in those curves. It says a lot about what's going on in the crop and air temperatures and so on. But the beauty of this system is that we can then pre-assess soil moisture. Then from that, we can approximate whether or not there's X or Y amount of biomass that we could generate. And then once we generate that amount of biomass, we could then terminate. And then we could roll into either a crop, probably not, probably then continue the fallow and then wait through possibly plant in that fall for a winter crop or the following spring for a spring crop. And so I believe as we migrate up across that rainfall gradient, we might be able to find more locations where it might be appropriate. Because it seems as though, from all the data I'm looking at, developing and finding, actually the data is hard to find. But once you get your hands on some of this biomass accumulation rate versus water use, transpiration data, you can then move forward quite quickly. But at the same time, we see that these darn crops are very similar in terms of how much biomass is generated per unit water. It's very consistent. So let's move on. Thank you. Okay, considerations. Water removal rate by a fully mature spring planted cover crop is approximately equal to that of a spring cereal crop. I determined that in 2014 data. I didn't show it. It's important to know that. A lot of people found that quite fascinating, which I don't understand because cover crops are crops. Anyway, replacement of fallow with a mixed cool season cover crop might be practical with early termination. I want to say that it sounds like a really good idea. Dryland systems. Now, keep in mind, we're thinking dryland systems. We're not in the wonderful humid Midwest where cover cropping systems have been so successful. Is it practical to plant a mixed winter cover crop in late summer after harvest? Typically, soils are so dry in the Pacific Northwest after a full growing season that it's very difficult to plant. Now, there are exceptions, and I think it would have to be determined on the day before planting, before you could do it, because many times the soils are so hard, you wouldn't be able to plant anyway. Practical grow cool season species as a winter forage crop? Yes, probably. Finally, collaborators, fantastic group of farmers that I worked with. I was starting out at WSU, and I was introduced to a number of great people, primarily through the NRCS groups. These guys are fantastic people, every last one of them. And then finally, I have to say again, thanks to Dave Huggins for his help, and thank you for attending. Well, it's the amount of, no, okay. Now recall that there was a regression line in terms of the amount of water removed versus biomass accumulated. Typically in the soil profile, you have to evaluate as to whether or not you can sacrifice the amount of water needed to produce enough biomass to then represent a need for cover crop or fill the void or need for a cover crop. If you're going to go through the entire growth phase of the crop from seeding to senescence and maturity and dry down, you're going to consume a huge amount of water, far more water than you would ever want to use with a simple cover crop, which is typically terminated when it's still vegetative, often at flowering, before or after flowering. Big difference. That's why.
Okay, I was just curious from your second, I think it was
Yeah, the comment at the end was that was a big question mark in the mind's eye of many people of how similar is a cover crop, because they're exotic species. Actually, daikon radish is not a common crop, you know, for example. And that the question was, how much more water do those species use than our crops? And it turns out that the daikon, which dominated a lot of our plots last year, removed very similar amounts of water as did the cereal grains.
I'm sorry, we're going to need to move on.
Thanks. Very good. Yep, thanks.